I'm going to put a box of electronics that's got a battery, an e-field sensor, a digitizer. I'm going to convert the amount of charge measurement, voltage measurement, charge measurement in the upper polonium source into a digital signal. I'm going to transmit that digital signal into a piece of fiber optics to the op amp that's in the middle of the yardstick. And I'm going to do the same thing on the lower polonium source. I believe I could set up a digitizing system, a chunk of electronics with local battery in a shielded box inside of the upper polonium source, associated with the upper polonium source, lower polonium source, two pieces of fiber optic cable going from those polonium sources to the op amp in the center, and I think I could now duplicate the Maynard Hill experiment without a piece of wire. So far, does that seem to make some sense to you, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, I don't think you're violating anything there, Dick. I think you should be able to. I think I'm following you, and it doesn't seem to violate anything.
I'm afraid that if we did that with the fiber optics, if I remove the wire that's always there in the usual measurement, you and I, when we do a volts per meter measurement in a laboratory at HF frequencies, we use this great big dipole-like structure. It's a cage dipole. And we set up the dipole. It's a conductor in space. And yes, if I had nothing but the magnetic field, by Faraday's law, I would induce a voltage in that wire, and I interpret that as volts per meter. But are the volts per meter really there when there really wasn't an upper conductor and a lower conductor and an imposed number of volts between the two? When you and I transmit that signal out of our dipole, not a single electron leaves the dipole. We're not putting charged particles into space, and that space doesn't contain the upper conductor and the lower conductor, which is the usual way of making a GTEM-like measurement of known E-field in volts per meter. Now let me show you another experiment. Let me drop. I could, if I wanted to, make a beautiful capacitor, air capacitor. I'm going to take 1 square meter of metal as my upper plate, 1 square meter of metal as my lower plate, and I put the two a millimeter apart. I'm going to have a hunking big capacitor. You and I can easily calculate the number of picofarad I'm going to get. I don't know the exact number. Maybe it's 1,000 picofarad. We're going to get a pretty big capacitor. Okay. I could resonate that capacitor by putting an inductor somewhere between the upper plate and the lower plate. Under normal circumstances, the current that flows in the wire that goes to the upper plate and the lower plate, by the way, when I'm putting a real RF voltage across that capacitor, the capacitor has a calculatable number of picofarads. Therefore, at my frequency, let me choose a frequency, 1 megacycle, it has a calculatable number of ohms of capacitive reactance. If I decide I'm going to put a 1 volt sine wave across that capacitor, and I know the capacitive reactance, by a simple Ohm's law-like calculation, I know exactly how many amperes of current I'm putting into the wire of the upper plate and the lower plate in order to do that charging and discharging to create that 1 volt across that capacitor. In the process of doing that, the current that flows in the wire is making a magnetic field, and the magnetic field is confusing things at first. However, because those two plates are so darn big, 1 square meter, because the wire goes to the middle of the upper plate, the wire goes to the middle of the lower plate, and those wires leave the vicinity of the plate at right angles to the plate, way out there in space, I curve it around, bring it to the inductor that does the resonating, or bring it to the signal generator, whichever. Because the plate...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because the upper plate and lower plate is so large compared to the spacing between the two, I am proposing that very little of the magnetic field of the current flowing into the upper and wire and lower wire going to those plates, very little of that magnetic field gets to the area between the two plates. And let me give you a piece of evidence of that. Let me drop. You and I have heard of enough people setting up a big parabolic dish antenna, like a ground station, where you got a 1,000-watt transmitter at the feed horn. And the signal coming out of that feed horn is a whopping big signal as far as radio frequency biohazard is concerned. The signal comes out of the feed horn, hits the dish, gets very nicely reflected and focused, and it becomes a beautiful beam out in space. If I stood at the vicinity of the apex of the dish, in front of that feed horn, I'm going to measure a lot of RF volts per meter. But I now take that instrumentation and put it directly behind the dish. Assuming the dish itself is made out of a piece of metal that's an eighth of an inch thick, I've only moved my instrumentation an eighth of an inch when I moved it from in front of the apex of the dish to behind the apex of the dish. I'm now going behind the dish. And when I do that, the amount of radio signal I measure back there is at least 30, maybe 35 decibels weaker. There's still some signal there, because you get a little bit of knife edge diffraction off the perimeter of the dish, and a little bit of the signal wraps around the side and comes back to the apex in the back. But in the back of that dish, I'm in a 30 decibel shielded environment, because that chunk of sheet metal of the dish itself is between me and that feed horn, and even though it's not a six-sided box as a Gaussian surface, it's a one-sided box, it still does a medium good job of shielding me by 30 dB. So far, are you with me on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Sure, I'm dead. Dick, continue.
Okay, so that flat sheet, that curved sheet of metal called parabolic surface, just one, it's a one-sided Gaussian surface. The other five sides of a six-sided, completely shielded box are not there. But it does 30 dB of shielding. So now I jump back to my 1 meter square upper plate and lower plate of this 1 millimeter separated capacitor, and I'm now saying that the magnetic field of the current flowing in that upper wire and the lower wire, very little of that is going to get between the two plates. And I could bring the experiment one step further. The perimeter of the upper plate, I could roll it down a little bit. The perimeter of the lower plate, I could roll it up a little bit, so that now there's an extremely narrow gap between the upper plate and the lower plate in the perimeter area. Yes, I'm going to increase the capacitance a little bit by the process of doing that, but because I've got a whole meter of capacitance of upper plate and lower plate, that's going to be a rather minor perturbation, but I can increase the amount of shielding by doing that. Now I've got a very narrow gap, and maybe I've made the 30 dB of shielding 50 dB of shielding. I can do magnetic shielding of this E-field generating device of these 2 1-meter squared plates acting as a capacitor. And now I'm putting 1 volt RMS, 10 volt RMS at 1 megacycle across the plates. I am speculating that I now have what you and I would call a radio waveguide. In other words, because I'm feeding the middle of our upper plate and the lower plate, it really is a kind of waveguide called radio waveguide, which is used in the case of making magnetrons and whatever. I've got a kind of transmission line in there. But there's something very unique about this transmission line. Let me drop. It is my guess that if I put instrumentation inside of that 1 millimeter spacing between the two plates, without a doubt I'm going to measure a significant E-field, a very calculatable E-field. I might not be able to measure an H-field because of the amount of shielding, or the amount of H-field is going to be 30 dB weaker than I would normally calculate by the normal transverse electromagnetic wave calculations. If that's true, if you and I built that apparatus, measured the voltage between the two, confirmed it, tried to measure the magnetic field between those two plates, and couldn't find it, it would be a pretty strong indication of a violation. Let me drop. The courses that you and I were subjected to in the electrical engineering schools we went to could be reinterpreted. I'm going to now do a super simplification, and that is a changing magnetic field generates an E-field. A changing E-field generates a magnetic field. Works in both directions. That's a reinterpretation of the Maxwell equations from one point of view. Here I've devised an experiment where I've got a changing E-field between those two plates. There might not be an H-field present. If so, it would be a partial confirmation of what I've been saying. There's a little more to this, but I better stop right here and find out how much of this violates the laws of physics as you know it, Glenn. And this is not going to be an easy one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
I'm definitely following what you're saying. I mean, I don't agree with your analysis at the end, but I agree with everything that you've said as far as your experiments and where you're coming from. There would certainly, if you take a piece of wire that's 1 meter in length and you attach it to a 1-volt battery, and you'll have 1 ampere turn across that length of 1 meter. But then again, you still have 1 volt per meter. Actually, it doesn't geometrically work out to 1 volt per meter. It's actually something less than 1 volt per meter. But you basically do have an E-field, even though it's not moving. In other words, if you have a battery there, and they're at right angles from each other. So yes, you do have lines of flux associated to the current in that wire, which is 1 ampere, and you're going to have an E-field at right angle to it that's not necessarily just in the wire. Keep in mind, the electrons that what we refer to as potential force, or EMF. Let's drop for a second. There's two components to E-field. E-field as far as the energy component, and there's E-field as far as the charge or electron Coulomb count, which we refer to as currents, current and voltage. When we look at, say, voltage across a wire or a load, there's an effect that we're moving currents. But there's also an effective field, which is the EMF, or the force, that's actually applied to allow current flow to take place, which is in turn by intensity or volts. Now, when you look at the space at right angles to this, there is an E-field, even in a static field deck. So in other words, it's not just in the wire. As a matter of fact, that field extends and folds off at the ratio of inverse square law. Now, the current, on the other hand, in terms of lines of flux, doesn't follow inverse square law. It follows geometric law. In other words, what's happening is you have lines of flux that are surrounding the path length of the original generation of that current field, and that follows a certain geometric pattern from there, which is at right angles. So, yes, you actually have an order square higher of fall off for the magnetic field than you do for the E field. Does that make sense, Dick? K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yes, it does. And with the traditional things that you and I have been taught for lots of years, and we've had confirmation from all the people we come in contact with, we have established a faith. And just to give you a quick example of another similar faith in the problems that happen, if you and I went to an Embry-Riddle course today and went through pilot flight training, it would be hammered into your head that the lift of a wing is generated by Bernoulli's principle. Even though today there's some significant experiments that say, no, it's Newtonian third law, action and reaction. You're taking a massive fluid called air. By the wedge effect, you're deflecting the air. That action and reaction gives you something called lift. It's the displacement of the air that's causing the lift, and Bernoulli is a very small fraction of it. That might be the reality. There's some significant experiments by respected scientists today saying that. However, today, you and I are in a Embry-Riddle course. Let me drop. We're in that flight training course. We're taking a final exam. The final exam asks you the question of where does the lift of a wing come from. And in order to pass the course to become a pilot, you and I on that exam will say that Bernoulli's principle is generating the lift of that wing. You say any other words, you fail that particular portion of the exam, you might not get your pilot license. I'm exaggerating a little bit. It could be after 10 years, I question 100 years of history, it could be dead wrong, and yet we're still teaching it. And people die because of it. Flight 587 is one of the examples, because that pilot didn't realize that that extremely heavy airplane in front of him was making some violently down-moving air by the process of it generating lift by a non-Bernoulli principle, and he flew directly behind it, and 280-some-odd people died in that experiment. That happened soon after 9/11. So there's errors there in something that is extremely well-established tradition. By the same token, in the electrical engineering courses you and I have taken, let me drop, you and I would have to say, by the Maxwell's equations, the way we were taught, the changing H-field generates an E-field, and the changing E-field generates an H-field. And here I am proposing an experiment challenging that. And maybe you and I will get a chance someday to carry out these experiments, because all of the experiments that you and I have really touched, like the GTEM, for instance, requires an upper conductor, a lower conductor, a voltage difference between the two, or a charge difference between the two, in order to establish a quantifiable E field. And then that RF wave in free space, the upper conductor, the lower conductor are not there. The electrons or any other charged particles are not there. All you've got is a magnetic field that you and I issued from that antenna that goes out into space, and by the usual method of measurement with the caged dipole, for instance, we see what looks like an E field, but it could possibly be nothing but an H field and Maxwell's equation that generates the E field. Just like the wing is developing lift with or without Bernoulli's principle, if you know what I mean. And when you ask the person who has a Bernoulli principle faith, let me drop it. You take a person with that faith that he's been using for all of his life as a pilot, and you ask him what happens when the wing is upside down. And you get some very funny looks on his face, and you start getting stuttering, and you get crazy sounding answers. How does the wing fly upside down? Or how does the water ski develop lift even though the water is not washing over the top of the ski? And then there's a whole lot of, water is a beautiful fluid, and that water ski is to a certain degree flying above the surface of that water. So even though I know I'm bucking a hell of a lot of tradition, even if I happen to be right, I know I'm going to get a hell of a lot of flack on this one. A lot of people are going to say, hey, he's lost it. He's gone over the edge. But as you can tell, I'm developing a serious doubt as to whether or not there really is an E field in that free space TEM wave. Am I completely crazy, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
No, I don't think so, Dick. I think what you're really expressing here is that, you know, what is the foundation of an electromagnetic wave? In other words, what we do, like you just exactly stated perfectly, was that we use a system of units of measure. And, okay, we have, you know, E field, and we have H field, and we have, you know, V over H, and we have basically this system of units that we follow. And what's interesting, the reason why that these things have been labeled and called what they are is because they started initially from very, very simple measurements. They started from the current in a wire, a solenoid, voltage on two plates, eventually battery and chemical measurements. And these original models were expanded upon over years and years and years, and a system of units was developed around it. Let me let this drop for a second. And from there, eventually, higher levels of science got involved, and they started using these units to describe other things. In other words, okay, like energy, in other words, what is the difference between, say, the energy and the electrical property? And then you get down to the subatomic level of electron volt. And, you know, then you have dipolar elements and other things. So these equations are very, very tightly wrapped around them. And, see, the reason why I always keep on referring back to an E field and an H field in free space or a vacuum is because it always goes back to the energy equation. In other words, yes, it's always nice to be able to talk about the physical environment because that's what we measure with. In other words, we're always measuring with electrons and copper wire and aluminum and other things and real space and real electrons, and we actually make the measurement in that arena where there's real mass. But the question always comes back to, how does it go through a real vacuum? Let it drop one more time. The reason that these equations for energy have worked out so well is that when you're looking at in free space, the magnitude of the E field and H field bounced around a normalized resistance of free space, you get a very interesting mathematical representation of what the electromagnetic wave is and all of the energy equations work. So in other words, when you look at displaced energy over space and distance, it definitely follows the inverse square law for voltage or E field and geometric law for the lines of flux or over the sine wave period, through space geometrically for the H field or the flux intensity in free space. So they are wrapped around each other at right angles, and it's just that the equations work. So that's what we're really bucking here, Dick, is, you know, you have to come up with new energy rules. K2IW, KC2QIQ. Not to say that they don't exist, it's just that that's where you're really bucking the system.
I'm going to 100% agree with you that the current equations work. And almost everything that takes place in science, you come up with a theory, you come up with a bunch of measurements, and you eventually come up with a model. I think this is what it looks like. I mean, Rutherford and Compton and all these other, Einstein, all these other genius guys in the turn of the century around 1900, thought they knew what a atom looks like. And they eventually came up to the conclusion that it's a solid core of protons and neutrons, and flying around it are some electrons. And in the early days, the model had them putting the electrons in simple round orbits around that nucleus. And for a while, that model worked, until you found some other exceptions to the model when you try to apply it to the real world, and you had to modify the model. All of science is like that. You have a model, and you modify it as you get more and more data downrange, and you suddenly realize that those electrons flying around there are much more complicated. Yeah, they've got that average radius, but they're not simple, round, flat orbits like planets going around the sun. Those hybrid suborbitals are a lot more complicated in the real world, okay? In the case of flight training of a pilot and Bernoulli's principle, a instructor at Embry-Riddle School, let me drop, will say, this is the way we've always done it for 100 years. It works. You might be right, but it's academic. This system, we got all the mathematics of Bernoulli's principle, and we've made it work. That's the model. It's good enough. Stop worrying about these details. The instructor might say that to you. And I might say in return, yeah, but when you get to the higher truth of what's really happening, you get a better explanation of why those people died. Okay? Right now, when it comes to the electromagnetic theory, a guy teaching the normal Maxwell's equations, fields and waves, course and whatever, will say that you might be right. We've got this branch of mathematics that for 150 years has worked, and you're coming up with an exception. What you think is an exception, but it's academic. It's good enough. The possibility exists downrange that if what I'm saying might be a higher truth, it might make a difference of a better understanding of an experiment, and there's even a slim possibility it makes a difference when it comes to life or death, when it comes to electromagnetic exposure of a human being. And this also relates to the chocolate bar, which we're not going to have time to get to tonight, but I've made some measurements of chocolate bars in a microwave oven that to me are striking, but that's another whole issue. So right now, yes, there's a slim chance that I've got slightly different understanding of a higher truth that is an exception to the normal traditional way, to the heritage of the way we teach electromagnetic theory. Most of the time, the model that we've been taught, the Maxwell equation approach, most of the time it works. I think we're eventually going to find with micro-miniature circuits, with graphene or whatever, that what's really happening at the atomic level, the molecular level, what's really going on is, once again, it's going to be a little bit more complicated. What else?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And so I'm proposing a set of experiments that are trying to refine the model, assuming that there could be an error in the model. You see where I'm going in this one, Glenn? And I know it's a long shot. I know I'm going to get a lot of flack, because I'm bucking 150, 170. Let's see, when did Maxwell do his work? Around 1840. So I'm bucking 270 years of tradition, 260 years of tradition. I know it's going to be an uphill battle, even if I happen to be right. And you're going to think about it. I'm going to think about it. We're going to propose other models, other confirmation techniques. We'll eventually get to the bottom of this, it says here, if we live long enough. Back to Glenn first. KT2QIQ, K2LIW.
It's a very interesting concept, Dick. I think what happens in most cases is that everything that we have now, like I said before, is based on a system of measurements that we've made in a system of units. But does it properly represent what the true electromagnetic wave is? It's good enough in terms of energy equations. When the energy equations, they're perfect. They are perfect. They really are, because it works for vacuum, it works for materials, atomic weights, everything is fine. But in other words, when we look at the interreaction with mass, electrons, and what's going on in between, that's where always the errors are, because we don't really and truly understand the atom yet. Yes, we have cloud theory, we have a lot of other things, But these models, like you're saying, are changing all the time. The interesting thing is that what's really funny is that whenever you work the energy equations, that's usually always how you back-proof the all of the subatomic things, because you always get the correct count from the energy, but you almost never, you know exactly for sure if you truly understand the mass, the electron count, the neutron, proton, you know, complete, have a full understanding of that. But you're right, exactly. How does the frame, you know, the electromagnetic wave, when you let it drop for a second? You know, do we have a real, I mean, I'm very disappointed in some of the dimensional images I've seen drawn of what an electromagnetic wave is. I mean, we know how the E field follows inverse square law, we know about the, you know, the general H field, other things, and how it can be measured. But is that really how it travels through free space? I'm not convinced. So there is some room to wiggle here, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, before I go over to Wes, let me complete a thought on this one. If you and I dig into what really is going on with some of these very elaborate computer programs that model antenna patterns, you find out what they're really doing. By finite element analysis and repetitive techniques and recursive techniques, they eventually calculate exactly how much current is flowing in each section of each one of the finite elements of a conductor. They calculate the current that flows here, there, and everywhere within the antenna structure. Once they know the current, they know by Faraday's law or Lenz's law or whatever, they know the amount of magnetic field that is being created in the amount of current that flows in that finite element. Then they go to a point in infinity in distance, and they add up all of those individual magnetic fields in a vector manner, in a spatial vector manner, the tensor diagram, so to speak, and you can do it from an energy point of view, and yes, conservation of energy has got to be withheld. And so it all works, so to speak. But the way the program really works, the inner workings of the program, the real core of the program, is calculating currents and magnetic fields and adding them up in space, and that becomes the antenna pattern. Another partial confirmation that magnetics is where the magic really is. Very few of the programs calculate the electronics at the finite element level. So that's another clue. And by the way, there's a 20% error in most of the diagrams. Let me show you on this one. If you and I study an LC network, I've got an inductor, a capacitor, and I get the right size inductor and capacitor so it resonates at 1 megacycle, for instance. And I know at the 1 megacycle rate what is happening is that the energy that you're talking about, conservation of energy, is being transferred back and forth. At one instant of time, at the peak of voltage, 1/2 CV², all of the energy that you and I are talking about conserving is in the capacitor. A quarter of a cycle later, as the voltage goes to zero, the current is maximum in the inductor, the voltage on the capacitor is zero, all of the energy is in the inductor. So in a real LC network, the energy that you and I want to conserve oscillates back and forth between the inductor and capacitor in a very predictable manner. When you drop? Okay. However, you'd be amazed how many people draw a diagram where they show you a three-dimensional picture of an electromagnetic wave propagating in the Z-axis, and what they do is to have the energy transferring back and forth between the E field and the H field, and they're dead wrong. It does not work that way in free space. Another confirmation is that there is no real capacitor there, so to speak. When you accurately draw the diagram, and of the diagrams you and I can find on the internet and sometimes in respect to textbooks, about 20% of them will have the H field maximum and the E field zero at this point in space, at this point in time, and a little bit further downrange, the other way around. They have the energy flipping back and forth between the E and the H in the free space TEM wave. Absolutely not true. Let me drop. When it's drawn correctly, an LC network and the way the energy behaves there is not anything like a free space wave. When you look at the real free space wave, at the instant in space, at the instant in time and the point in space where the H is maximum. At that exact instant and point in time, the voltage is also maximum, assuming that now that we use the conventional method of analysis. In other words, the TEM wave in space, from one point of view, is bundles of energy, where at the point where the H is maximum, the E is maximum at that point. And at a slightly different point, where the H goes through zero, the E goes through zero simultaneously at that point. There are bundles of energy. It has to be that way. Because in order to have the pointing vector work, we have to now, from a heuristic point of view, my thumb is pointing in the direction that you think is going to be the direction of propagation. My fingers are pointing in the direction of E. This is a vertically polarized wave. My fingers are pointing at 12 o'clock, straight up. And now I'm going to rotate my hand so that my fingers are at 3 o'clock. I'm going to rotate from E toward H. When I do that E crossed H phenomenon by rotating of my hand, the advancement of a right-handing screw tells me the magnitude and the direction of propagation of that wave. That's the pointing vector. For that to work, E and H have to hit peak, maximum, at the same point, and minimum at the same point. If you had the E going through zero in the middle of H, then on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, you'd have two different pointing vectors in two different directions. It wouldn't work. At least 20% of the respected books and respected articles you and I can go to have that backwards. I wonder if you've been familiar with that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt on this one, Dick, but yeah, no, there's a reason why that is. In other words, back to one piece of wire again. In other words, if you take a piece of wire and you have basically a 1-volt battery, and let's say there's a complete distributed resistance across that 1 meter of wire, that's 1 ohm. So we can say that there's 1 ampere, 1 volt, across that wire. So now you know you have 1 ampere turn. You know that the loop of that wire, its length and diameter, its cross section, you know everything about its physical length, that you can measure the static field and say that yes, that E field, which is 1 volt per meter, or something a little bit less than that, but it's at maximum at that point, and the current's at maximum because the battery's connected in a steady state. And if you start varying that battery up back and forth, plus and minus with the signal generator, it goes up and down. So when you measure the field at that point of wire, okay, yes, the E field and the H field in the first path length are in phase directly, and they're both at maxima and minima at the same time. Now let's talk about a vector that's moved at a cross-section from the wire itself, from the initial path length. The voltage or E field at that point at the right angle to that wire is going to be moving out at a rate of, as you know, of inverse square. The geometric lines of flux are at right angles to the intensity of the E field. So what's actually happening is that you have a lead lag problem between the E and the H, so that when you're looking at progressive field in a forward direction, you wind up with 90 degrees of difference between the E and the H field per line of flux to the next, I believe, is it one cycle or quarter cycle. But there is a phase shift as you're moving progressive from the source deck. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And we've got a problem here, Glenn. When you said there's a 90-degree difference, you didn't make it clear. Are you speaking spatially or temporally? And in the case of the near field of an antenna, all kinds of crazy things happen and crazy phase shifts and whatever. What really counts when it comes to setting that wave 123 astronomical units from Voyager back to Earth, the real free space wave, do you still think that there is a temporal difference between the E and the H at one instant of time, at one point in space? My understanding of the classic, correct, present understanding of a free space, planar TEM wave is that there is 0 degrees of phase shift temporally between the E and the H. There is spatially 90 degrees of difference between the orientation. In other words, the E might be at 12 o'clock and the H is at 3 o'clock. spatially there's a quadrature, there's a 90 degree difference spatially, but in temporal properly drawn diagram, at the instant E hits maximum, H hits maximum. Do you agree or disagree on that one, Glenn? KT2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, I sure do, Dick. It's semantics. Think about what's happening. If when you're talking about a piece of wire in one path length and the wire goes around, E and H are completely in phase. Now, that's temporally. Okay. Now, in free space, when you're moving at a vector in a direction, okay, spatially, they will be 90 degrees apart. So when somebody's trying to draw these things in textbooks, unless they actually tell you exactly what they're describing there, both could be correct. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
No, I don't agree. If the drawing is an isometric drawing, and you have a bunch of arrows in purple going up and down representing E field, in blue you have a bunch of arrows going left and right representing H field, and you're looking at this at a isometric point of view. You're not looking at it straight on. You're not looking at it planar. You're looking at it at a crazy angle. It's an isometric drawing in the classic way of a Cartesian coordinate-like thing. Now, when you see a number of those waves in space, at the instant the red arrows go through zero, the blue arrows go through zero, and they both reverse in phase and can continue. So although the blue arrows are up and down and the red arrows and the red arrows are up and down, the blue arrows are left and right, spatially the 90 degrees in angle away from each other, temporally they're coincident. Do you agree or disagree? Free space wave now, Glenn, not near field of an antenna. KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I disagree, Dick. And here's why. If you look at lines of flux, in other words, if you were to go back to like an original magnet again, or a magnetic field, and you draw it in magnetic lines of field intensity, and you draw them out geometrically, you'll find out that the lines of flux follow the path length. The E field is at right angles from the path length. So in the first path length, they're both at maximum. When they're moving away, when you have a reversal of from plus positive voltage to minus voltage in sine wave or any other waveform, but it will typically always uniform itself to sine wave in free space. What eventually will happen is you're going to have the lines of flux re-intersecting, and you're going to have an amplitude of fall off at inverse square, and you're going to have a geometric at a right angle to the E field in free space that's going to be at 90 degrees due to the numbers of lines of flux, which are at a different amplitude than inverse square. It's actually pi, I used to know this off the top of my head, not right now, but it's less. But when you do that division in between, there is a 90 degree difference between the maximum of the E field and the H field in free space around a resistive component of 377 ohms. So in a progressive signal moving forward, yes, there is 90 degrees difference, Dick.
Okay, you and I have got a definite point of disagreement on this one. Stand by for a second. Okay. In free space, 377 ohms, the usual number we use, 120 pi, if it is a resistive, non-reactive thing, then between voltage and current, there can't be a phase shift. If I put a voltage on a pure resistor, voltage and current are in phase with each other. No quadrature there. Only a reactance gives me a quadrature.
Second?
I don't think free space is reactive. Second of all, are you telling me that in this isometric diagram, where I'm showing a whole bunch of arrows in a sinusoidal manner, red arrows for the envelope is sinusoidal for red on E and blue for H, are you telling me that in that diagram properly drawn, where E is maximum, are you telling me H is going through zero at that point in time, at that point in space? Is that what you're saying, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
When you look at E field and H field, okay, and you look at the resistive impedance in free space, that's, you're analyzing one path length. but when you're talking about a progressive signal falling off at the square, in other words, the amplitude is changing with each additional path length. So in other words, your path lengths are intersecting each other from the first path to the second path to the third path, and they're moving out in a geometric, three-dimensional positioning from let's say it's an isotropic source. So it's moving outward. Now, if you redraw the lines of flux and then the E field around the H field, you're going to get a progressive drop of difference in amplitude between E and H in free space. Now, every time you analyze a specific point in space with the resistive component, yes, you will always see E and H at maximum at one particular point. But when you're looking at progressive vector in one direction, the one is always leaving a component of H behind with respect to E at the degrees of 90. So depending on how they're describing the progress, in other words, when you're looking at a textbook and what the author is trying to describe at that particular time, if he's talking about the progressive rate of E versus H, there will be 90 degrees of shift. If you're talking about the specific point in space at any one time of measurement, E and H will always be equal. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Maybe we've got a semantic problem here. Now let me try it from another point of view. Assume I've got a completely planar free space wave that started off at an infinite distance from me. By the time it got to me, there was no curvature. It's a flat thing. I'm taking a snapshot. And in my snapshot, three or four consecutive cycles of the RF are being displayed. I'm taking a snapshot in time. I'm freezing time. I'm looking at three consecutive waves of E and H with their proper colors and the proper orientations being displayed in an isotropic manner. In that snapshot in time, I've stopped time and I'm looking at three of the waves that occurred in this volume of space that I'm looking at. Here's my question. In that method of display, are E and H simultaneously maximum? Do E and H simultaneously go through zero on certain sections of each one of those three waves in that snapshot? Do you agree or disagree on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
I don't think this is a matter of disagreement. I think what it's a matter of is definition and explanation. If you look at any one field line from the original path length of the isotropic radiator, but of course the isotropic radiator can't be really isotropic if it's a piece of wire. It does have some phase, but getting, without confusing the issue here too much, but if you were to draw the three progressive waves as you've shown, in any one of those progressive waves from the initial source, what you'd measure is a E and an H that are in phase in 377 ohms, provided you're enough wavelength. So I'm not sure if 3 is enough. You might need more like 8 to 10 or something like that before you'd see true alignment between E and H, probably even more than that. But what really happens when you look at any one specific, yes, E and H are in phase. But what's changing is the amplitude. If you're looking at the amplitude of E versus the amplitude of H, they're falling off at different rates. That's what I'm trying to get at here. So when somebody is describing in a textbook a vector in one direction to demonstrate the difference in amplitudes of E versus H, it's nonlinear. That's what the problem is, Dick. So there is a phase shift associated to the difference in amplitude because one is a geometric fall off, the other one is just standard inverse square. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, we've got a problem, and I didn't make it clear. You talked about an isotropic source. When I'm an infinite distance from the source, where the source was a 50 decibel dish parabolic antenna, or whether the source was isotropic, if I'm an infinite distance from it, I cannot tell the difference. And the three waves I'm talking about are not three waves away from the source. I'm an infinite distance. I'm 123 astronomical units away from that source. That wave that passes me is perfectly planar. And you tell me what the E is and my 377 ohms, I know exactly what the H is. at each instant of time. I'm an infinite distance away from the source. I'm looking at three consecutive cycles in the volume of space that I'm analyzing at a great distance. Are you saying there is quadrature in time between those waves, or only quadrature in spatial orientation, E up and down and H left and right, so to speak, 90 degrees difference between the two? But I'd like to say that if free space is a resistor of 377 ohms, there is no reactance here. You tell me the magnitude of E, I tell you the magnitude of H exactly. And whether as I move further away and they're falling off by some kind of an inverse square law, if the E has gone down to half, the H has gone down to half of what it used to be. There's an exact relationship between the two related to the 377 in this volume of space, an infinite distance from the source. Agree or disagree? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
There is a relationship between E and H, but they're not linear. That's the difference. So in other words, yes, you're correct. In a resistor, there's no reactance in free space. It's just energy displaced. Geometrically, you have an inverse square from the source, but you have another relationship that's non-linear between E and H over progressive distance. So when you're looking at the ratio at which E is dropping off versus the ratio of H is dropping off, they're falling off at non-linear rates from each other. So in other words, when you're looking at, basically, yes, you can always measure an E field at some distance because there's something left of it. But the amount of H field that's so diminished at so many light years away, I don't even think that any H is detectable. That's how small the numbers start becoming, Vic. K2IW, KC2QIQ. That's why most antennas are always designed to monitor the E field. Because after any kind of length of distance, H becomes, really, really tiny.
I don't agree, Glenn. I'm making a measurement with my Goldstone dish. I'm listening to that signal from Voyager. He's transmitting from me a long distance away. That's essentially infinity. I've measured the magnitude of that electromagnetic wave coming down that dish, and they're doing that. And you say there's a nonlinear relationship in the way they fall off. Inverse square law is nonlinear, yes, but the relationship between an H, I say, is linear. Right now, Voyager's 123 astronomical units away. In theory, someday he's going to be twice the distance. 123 becomes 246 astronomical units. You double the distance of Voyager, inverse square law, the voltage goes to one-half of what it used to be, the E goes to one-half, the H goes to one-half of what it used to be. They both fall off in a purely linear manner of voltage versus distance and H versus distance. That's what I was taught. Are you disagreeing with that? To me, that is linear. E is linear with distance. H is linear with distance. Since energy is E squared or H squared, yes, they fall off by square law in energy, but the E vector, linear with distance, H vector, linear with distance. You agree or disagree? KC2QIQ, K2LAW? And by the way, a lot of textbooks are written that way.
That's completely wrong, if that's what you're interpreting from it. And I'll tell you why. It's because when you even think about it, it's so obvious. NI over LE, okay, is the basic foundation of H. In other words, what's creating an Oersted. In other words, if you look at the number of ampere turns in a path length, that's I. As you start moving from the original path to the next wave, the path length is getting geometrically larger. As you diminish for the same amplitude, it's being divided by the increased length of the distance. So that's why it's obviously not linear, even with respect to the E field. So if the E field is falling off by inverse square, you're falling off by the geometric length distance of the path length from the source. So it's obviously a huge reduction in H field over distance from the original path. But as you pointed out, in a specific resistive 377 ohms in any one point in space, the relationship is exact in that one moment of time. But from the original source, the length is getting longer and longer and longer from the original H established field. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Let me go one step at a time. You'd be amazed how many antenna measurements are made in the following manner. I'm in the far field of the antenna under test. Let me pick a number, 100 meters away of an antenna that's got a near field of 1 meter. I'm 100 meters away. I measure, let me pick a number, 2 volts per meter coming from that antenna as it transmits right now. I'm 100 meters away. I go to 200 meters away. Whatever number of volts per meter I used to measure goes to exactly half the number of volts per meter. Linear relationship of voltage versus distance. Lots of antenna books are written that way. Let's just talk about voltage first. Are they wrong? Over to you, Glenn. KQLIW?
They're right on the money.
Okay. Other books will tell you that the relationship between E and H is related by the impedance, that if I measured the amps per meter of H field coming from the antenna at this distance, in the far field, and I double the distance, the amps per meter go to one half. You agree or disagree?
That's a loaded question. And the reason I'm going to say that is because it's obvious here again, if you understand an electromagnetic wave. If you look at lines of flux, okay, there are more than one. So in other words, when you're looking at any one line of flux in a particular application, yes, in that one line of flux, but in terms of the total field intensity, that's not the correct representation of H.
KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Okay, we just got cut off. I'm coming in by another means. That was technet number 1436. I've been saying it backwards, by the way. I've been reversing the 4 and the 1 for months, for weeks at least. We'll pick this up later. I'm going to mail you a couple of websites that I have respected. And we're making progress, in my opinion. But we've got a ways to go yet. Thank you, Glenn. More to follow. Be kind to each other, you guys. We'll be back next week. We'll get a little closer to the bottom of all this. If we lose the bottom. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Bye-bye, John. K2RIW, clear and listening.
Victor Echo 3, Juliet India Whiskey, listing.
I'll go right ahead, Jim. I know I'm a little bit noisy, but hopefully you can hear me. Juliet India Whiskey, K2RIW.
Yes, K2RIW, the E3JIW. Well, I followed the net. I was handheld driving through the city, a couple of different machines in Toronto carrying it, and as usual, interesting, and thank you. And sometimes after the net, my friend Scott, who's east of me, comes on and we chat. I hear you. There's some noise, but no, I hear you, and I'm noisy because I'm going to a repeater that's quite a way away from me. But thank you.
Yeah, you're a lot quieter to the machine than I am, Jim. And so I'm not going to make people suffer with this signal. I'm listening to my signal coming back out of the machine, and I'm 50% noise and 50% audio. Bye-bye, you all. We should probably get to the bottom of all this next week. K2RIW clear.
Oh, hey, in terms of weather, we got 12 inches of snow on average, and we now are just getting the start of rain, so most people survived the storm, and that's all from Toronto. Anna!
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.